One is in your simple Ginzu model with, on the option side, there's a circular reference. How do you get around that one?
The iteration.
What's
there
that?
Has to be a circular reference. Right?
Okay, so I don't have to touch it. The error
just go into the iteration box.
Okay.
You know how you, in preferences in Excel, there's a little edit. Make sure there's a check on the box, otherwise the spreadsheet won't even work.
Under preferences.
Yeah.
And then when you talk about stock price volatility, how are you calculating? So if I like rip out all the historical prices, how would I go about calculating into a percentage?
You get weaker days. First,
daily.
Daily prices.
Yeah.
So you'd have to get the standard deviation
okay.
in the returns.
Okay.
The
oh, okay.
And then multiply by 250.
In returns, and then multiply by?
250 to make it annual.
Oh.
So that's why I asked you whether it's daily
okay.
or weekly. Or
but why? So the return is from the day one of your?
Return day one to day two, day two to day
got
three.
It.
So take the so if you have 200 days, you'll have 199
plus
the standard deviation multiplied by 250
so,
because they're up.
So I was doing it by closing pricing, which is like those coming out really
you get,
odd.
Yeah, if you get daily, it will give you a daily standard deviation or an annualized number.
Got it. Okay.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
These are prospective students.
Hi. Pleasure.
Pleasure to meet you.
Chris Trulia. Yeah.
Chris Hamlin. It's great to
nice
meet you.
Meet you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Wherever you want to sit.
It can be a dressed APE or it can be the market.
As long as your variables, your fundamentals you use are consistently defined, it doesn't matter, right? I can divide anything by any other number.
Okay.
I can divide by earnings 5 years ago. If I need that.
So it must be consistent because of the factors that you use.
Exactly. You can't double count. You use forward PE, you've got to be very careful because you're using next year's earnings and your growth includes that growth from next year.
Mm-hmm.
You're double counting the growth.
Oh, okay. I see.
Okay?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My long what?
Twitter?
Yeah.
I've been, oh, all right.
You're 25 and a half now, right?
No. Oh, 25 and a half? Yeah. I've been slowly adding. So.
Okay, let's get started. What I thought I'd do with the start of the, class test, but much of almost all the questions are in the first few pages, so I thought I'd kind of bring it in as we go through. Okay? So let's look at where we were last session. We're talking about valuing private businesses, right? We're talking about getting, the basic process stays the same, but you still need cash flows. You still need a discount rate, you still need a growth rate, and you still need to estimate how much you reinvest. Am I too loud?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you still need to estimate how, am I too soft now? I'm okay. So tell me when I get the Goldilocks effect. That's right, okay. You have to still figure out how much you're reinvesting to get that growth. So we're talking about the challenge in coming up with a discount rate for a private company. You need a cost of equity, you need a cost of debt. And we started the process exactly the way we did for a public company. We looked at other public companies in the same space as the private business. We came up with an unlevered beta for being in the restaurant business. And then we said it's a high-end restaurant, so we're going to use the unlevered beta for retailers, high-end retailers, so 1.18. So that's where we are right now. But we have two problems. One is beta measures only the portion of the risk you cannot diversify away. And the way I set up this problem is you're buying this restaurant and you're putting all your money into this restaurant, which means you're not going to be diversified. So that's the first challenge we're going to face. The second is if we can get over the challenge, we still have to deal with how do you come up with a debt-to-equity ratio for a private business, because the debt and equity are supposed to be market values. So let me take the first part of that challenge, and let me set up an algebra problem. Let's assume you have a company with 100 units of risk. Forget about betas. Forget about all that nifty Greek stuff. Let's say you have 100 units of risk. Let's say 20 units of risk in this company come from macroeconomic sources, inflation, interest rates, what Janet Yellen does. That's the risk you cannot diversify away. The remaining 80 units are company specific. With a public company, what do we assume? The 80 units get averaged out in your portfolio. You get rewarded only for the 20 units, and you measure those 20 units with a beta. Okay? So up till there, everybody's with me, right? Now, let's assume you're not diversified. You buy this company. How many units of risk are you exposed to? You're exposed to all 100 units, right? So if you thought the beta was 0.8 for the company as a diversified investor, but you're now exposed to all of the rest of the risk, roughly speaking, what should your beta look like? 5 times as much risk, right? 20 units gave you a beta of 0.8. Your beta should be, if I scaled it up, about 5 times 0.8, which is 4. Does everybody see the logic of what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to take the risk that is captured in the beta saying, hey, you know what? That measured only the risk you cannot diversify. Well, you happen not to be diversified. So I'm going to scale the risk up to reflect the fact that you're not diversified. So I got the unlevered beta for those retailers, right? 1.18. That tells me the 20 units of risk. Is there a way I can figure out how much of the risk in a publicly traded retail company comes from firm-specific sources? Where did I get the beta? From a regression, right? The slope of the line was the... Were there any other pieces of output from the regression that I might find useful in answering the second question? I have the intercept, I have the beta, what else? I have the R squared of the regression, which tells me what? How much of the variance is explained by the market, right? So I can get that for each regression. The R squared is a rough measure of how much of the risk in a company comes from the market if you're looking at the variance. So that's what I did. I looked up the average R squared across the high-end retailers. It's about 25%. So think of each regression. I'm pulling up the beta and the R squared of each one. I get an average R squared of 25%. I'm almost home. Here's a final one small statistical detail that can get you into trouble. Betas are standard deviation measures. You might have no idea what I'm talking about, but if you look at the statistical definition of beta, it's rho JM. It's a correlation between the stock and the market times the standard deviation of the stock divided by standard. Everything is in standard deviation terms. R squared tells me how much of my variance comes from the market. Because I'm looking at the square root of the variance, I should be looking at the square root of the R squared, which of course is R, or the correlation coefficient. The square root of 25% is 0.5. Don't say 5%. I know it's one of the most trickiest things in statistics, because R squared's are percentage squared. So it's 0.25. You've got to take the square root of 0.25, which is 0.5. So correlation is 0.5. I'm going to take the 1.18 unlevered beta and divide by the 0.5. I'm doing very similar to what I did in the previous page. I'm doing the algebra. I'm saying, if you're not diversified and you're investing in this restaurant, that's like investing in a stock with a beta of 2.36. That becomes my unlevered beta. So all I'm doing is adding one layer to what I did with public companies. Public companies, I just took the unlevered beta and ran with it. Here I'm saying, you know what, I can't do that because you're not diversified. I'm going to scale up the beta to reflect the rest of the risk. And I call this a total beta to reflect the fact that you're looking at total risk and not just at market risk. Traditional betas focus just on market risk. Any questions? Last step is I need a debt-to-equity ratio, right? And I don't have market debt and I don't have market equity. There are two choices you have. The first is to take the debt-to-equity ratio of the publicly traded companies in this space and say, hey, you know what? I'm a private business, but I'm going to have to follow those same rules as public companies and use that debt-to-equity ratio. And here what I did was I looked at the debt-to-equity ratio not of retailers, but of restaurants. Do you see why I have to go back to a debt-to-equity? Even though my unlevered beta is based on retailers, the way I run a business as a restaurant is I've got to lease the restaurant. The kinds of debt I'm going to cover are pretty similar to a restaurant. So the debt-to-equity ratio of a retailer is 14. It's an assumption. I'm assuming that as a private company, your debt-to-equity ratio would be similar to the industry average. You're saying, I don't like that. That's too simplistic. I have a solution, but it'll take a little bit of contortion on your part. If you go into the Excel preferences, there's that iteration box that you might see in the... Just put an X in that box. Do that first before you do what I'm going to suggest next. You can use your own estimated values of debt and equity for the company as the weights in your cost of capital. The reason it's a little tricky is to get those values, you need the cost of capital. To get the cost of capital, you need the weights. So basically, you create circularity. But your spreadsheet will actually work fine. So if you don't like to use the industry average, you can use your estimated values. Either way, you're trying to come up with an estimate of the debt to equity. Here's what you can never use. You can never use book debt to equity ratios because you don't have market value. Okay? So I've seen private companies valued using book debt to equity. Don't do that. That's the worst possible choice you can make. Either use an industry average or your estimated values. My debt to equity ratio that I used for this restaurant is 14.33%. which gives me a levered total beta of 2.56 and a cost of equity of 14.5%. So is everybody clear on the process? If you have a private business, then don't just take the beta and plug it in. Think about what that risk will look like to your potential buyer. If that buyer is not diversified, I've just scaled up your risk and pushed up your cost of equity. The cost of debt is relatively straightforward. I'm going to do exactly what I did with public companies. I'm going to add a default spread. The default spread I'm going to add on is going to be based on my synthetic rating. You're saying private businesses are not rated. Lots of public companies are not rated either. That didn't stop me from estimating a synthetic rating. It's based on your interest coverage ratio, which private businesses have just like public businesses. The rating that I attached to this business was BB+, which results in a default spread of 3.25%. The tax rate I used was the marginal tax rate you would face as an individual in this business. It gives me a cost of debt after taxes of 4.5%. So I'm going to use the same process for estimating cost of debt for a private business as I did for a public. My final cost of capital is a weighted average of the cost of equity and the cost of debt using the same debt to equity choices you made when you levered the beta. Cost of capital for the company is 13.25%. I have the discount rate I need to discount the cash flows on this restaurant. So don't make this a completely new process. Just because you have a private business doesn't mean you have to abandon everything you've done so far. All it means you've got to add that additional step at the cost of equity and the cost of debt to come up with your cost of capital. Now let's look at the earnings. This is a much more conventional part of the process. I look at the income statement and I have to ask questions. Why? Because it's a private business. It might not be the number I want to use in my valuation. According to the chef who's trying to sell the business, the net income was $240,000. The operating income was $400,000. But there are two things he did that will probably mean that these numbers are not reliable. The first is he treated, like all accountants do, leases as operating expenses. I want to convert the lease into a financial expense. So that's the first conversion. I'd have done that for a public company as well, a public restaurant or a public retailer. The other item, and this is unique because it's a private business, is the chef didn't charge himself a salary. Why? It was his restaurant. Why should he care whether he gets the money out as a salary or whether he gets it out as dividends? But if I buy this restaurant and I don't set aside that money, what's going to happen the day after I buy the restaurant? I'll have a nice restaurant. I'll walk in and say, who's cooking food today? Remember, you're an investment banker till yesterday. If you say, look, I'll cook the food, this French restaurant is destined for doom. So you've got to hire somebody who actually knows how to cook. And I've set aside an extra $150,000. And that'll depend on how high end you have to go. $150,000 might be a drop in the bucket. You might need $1.5 million, $2 million, whatever you have to do. You've got to put that expense in there. That pushes up my expenses. My operating income becomes $370,000. I now have an imputed interest expense from my leases converted to debt. But basically, I'm redoing your financials because I have to look at the company I will be owning next year, not the company you were owning last year. Any questions? Now I have to pause and ask, what will happen if I do hire a chef and I open the doors tomorrow and everybody finds out that the old chef has left? Let's face it, top-end restaurants, it's the name of the chef that brings you in there. Right? You walk through Vegas now, you've got all these big name restaurants, right? And it's, in fact, the chef's not there, but you actually walk in expecting the chef to be in the kitchen actually cooking your stuff. But the name of the chef is what drew customers in. See, what you have to be wary of is you might have a great restaurant making a lot of money run by a well-known chef. You buy the restaurant based on the income, and the next day you come in and the number of people who come for dinner drops off. That's a key person discount I talked about. With small private businesses, you have to factor it in, whether you're buying a plumbing business, a dental business, a medical practice, or a top-end restaurant. If you're buying a diner, who cares? I mean, anybody can scramble eggs, so basically you say, I don't care who the chef is. But the more high-end the restaurant becomes, the more you have to worry about, you know, will those people keep coming? In this case, I've assumed that because this chef is leaving, that the revenues will drop off 20%. You say, how would I ever find that out? No, you'd have to try, though. You'd have to stand outside the restaurant and tell people as they come in, so will you still come to the restaurant if I had a different chef there? I mean, you might get thrown out for doing it, but there is no way you cannot deal with this. You can't say, I'm going to assume it away, because that would be a dangerous thing to do. So that's basically the 20% drop in operating income. I'm now at $296,000. I'm almost, and we talked a little bit about how the old chef, because this affects both you and the old chef who's trying to sell the restaurant, right, because he gets a lesser value. We talked a little bit about how he might be able to smooth out this impact by kind of hanging around for a couple of years saying, look, I'll give my name to the restaurant and gradually withdraw as people get more used to who the new owners are. So there might be ways you can mitigate the effect, but I brought it in the best way I can into my income. And we're now ready to do the valuation, but just because you're valuing a private business doesn't mean you can abandon all the rules we had about valuing public companies. To grow, what do you have to do? You have to reinvest. To figure out how much you need to reinvest, you need a return on capital. In this case, I'm going to assume that because this restaurant is already at capacity, that I can grow only 2% a year. Do you see why these assumptions will have to kick in? You're at half of capacity. You might have a 10% growth rate for the next 5 years before you level it out. Here are 2% growth rate. Because I have a 2% growth rate and the return on capital that this restaurant earns on its invested capital is 20%, that'll mean that I have to reinvest about 10% of my after-tax operating income each year. That's pretty much it. I've got my cash flows, I got my discount rate, I got my reinvestment rate. It's a stable growth company, so there's my valuation of the company. $296,000 is the key person adjusted operating income, 2% is the growth rate, 40% is the tax rate, 10% is the reinvestment rate, 13.25% is the cost of capital based on the total beta. The value that I get for the restaurant is $1.45 million. Don't be in a hurry and pay that amount, because remember, that is the value of the restaurant. There's a lease that you've capitalized that has a value of $928,000. You subtract that out, the value that you would pay for your equity stake in the restaurant is $521,000. Not quite, though, because that assumes that if you buy the restaurant and change your mind, that there are no consequences. We talked about illiquidity earlier, right? If you have a private business, you worry a lot more about, will I be able to sell this business if I change my mind? So here's the last step. You have to consider the cost of illiquidity. I call illiquidity the cost of buyer's remorse. You know the cost of buyer's remorse is? First, have you ever had buyer's remorse? Say it's 3:30 and you're sitting there watching CNBC. Is Jim Cramer on at 3:30? Let's say he's on. And Jim has this habit of yelling out the name of a stock every 12 seconds, right? How many stocks has he recommended? 2,000 in the last 5 years? And he yells out the name of a stock. In a moment of weakness, you actually buy the stock. Horrible mistake. Right after you hit the buy, you say, oh my God, what have I done? I've listened to a crazy guy screaming at me, and I bought the stock. You change your mind. It's a cost of buyer's remorse, and you sell the stock instantaneously. With a public company, what's the cost of buyer's remorse? There's the transactions cost, which is what, $8.95 you're in E-Trade. What's the other cost? There's a bid-ask spread, right? So how big can it be? For IBM, it's nothing. But if it was some small company you listened and bought, it could be 10%, 15%, 20%. So with a public company, the cost of buyer's remorse is whatever you you essentially have to lose. And that could be 5, 10 if it's an illiquid small company, but it can be very small. If it's, what I'm trying to point out here is illiquidity is a continuum. Every investment is illiquid. The question is to what degree. But let's say in a moment of weakness this evening, while you're walking by this French restaurant, you take your entire, you might not have $1.5 million in your hand or 521,000. Let's say your entire family savings is 521,000. As you walk by this restaurant, this is a nice restaurant. I'm going to buy it. You buy it. You take your entire wealth and you buy it. You get home and you tell your spouse what you did. She says, what? You did what? Go back and sell it. Imagine how much more difficult this is going to be. What are you going to do? Hang out at the restaurant and say, you want to buy this restaurant? You want to buy this restaurant? Illiquidity is a clear and present danger with private companies, which is one reason when people value private companies, they actually explicitly reduce the value for what they call an illiquidity discount. 20 years ago when I first started getting aware of this process, now, I was giving a keynote speech to a group of appraisers, and I said, I asked about this illiquidity discount. They said, we use 25%. I said, what? They said, whatever private company we value the company, and we knock off 20 to 25%. I said, why? He said, well, that's what we do. And that's actually the state of practice in a lot of private company valuations, knock off a constant from your value. 20% doesn't sound like much. But can you imagine valuing Coke Industries or Cargill? These are multi-billion-dollar companies and knocking off 20%. That's leaving, what, $2 billion on the table, right? So let's step back and ask a different question, which is, should this discount vary across companies? And I think the answer has to be, obviously, yes. In fact, it should vary across companies depending on how small or large the company is. A company that's a $10 billion company, I shouldn't be knocking off 20%. Maybe a smaller company I need to because it's of the nature of illiquidity. It should vary across time. If I were trying to sell something during a market crisis, the cost of illiquidity is much greater than when times are good. And it should vary across people. Know what I mean by vary across people? Who values liquidity the most? People who need cash, right? If you're the kind of investor, buyer, who really can afford to let an investment ride, you value liquidity less than the next person. Which means the discount I should be attaching when I sell my business to you should be far smaller than if I'm selling. So it should vary across companies, vary across time, and vary across buyers, which means you can't use 25% for all companies. So let's look at this process of how you estimate the cost of illiquidity. I'm going to start off by telling you where the 20 to 25% discount you see in private company valuations come from. They come from two sets of studies. And these two studies have something very interesting going on. These are studies where there's a public market price and they can observe a price at which an illiquid transaction got done. I'll give you an example. Now, whether you've heard of this phenomenon of restricted stock. In the US, if you're a company that needs to issue shares to the market, you got to go through the SEC approval process. It's not a hugely onerous process, but you got to go through it. It takes time. It takes money. You are allowed as a U.S. company to issue shares without going through the SEC approval process in what's called restricted stock. You think, so why doesn't every company do it? If you issue restricted shares, the people getting these shares are not allowed to trade these shares for a year after they get them. So you ready? Let's play a game. Let's assume I'm a public company and my share price is $10. And you're a portfolio manager and I come to you and say, look, I have 1 million shares that I'd like you to buy. But you can't trade these shares for a year. The price is $10. Would you pay $10 for those shares? No, you'd demand a discount, right? And I can observe what that discount is because that price is a public price. So the restricted stock studies, that's what they do. They look at companies that issue restricted stock, they look at the market price, and then they look at the price at which the restricted offering is made, and they take the difference and say that's a discount for illiquidity. So if the price is 10 and people are saying, look, I'll pay only 8, that's a 20% discount. They say that's an illiquidity discount. So that's the oldest set of studies, is restricted stock studies. They go back to the 1970s. The second set of studies, which are more recent, the last 10 or 15 years, are studies that look at transactions prior to IPOs. I'll give you an example. Square has an IPO coming really soon, right? Like today? What's the price? $12 is what they finally decided? So let's take $11.50 as the price. So you have the IPO price. If you look at the last 3 or 6 months, there might have been people who are owners, founders, investors in Square who had to trade with each other. You see where this is going? These studies look at, I think, a six-month window before IPOs. They look at the price at which owners traded shares, and they compare it to the IPO price. So let's say the Square price is $11.50, and you were willing to sell your shares to me 3 months ago at $10. They said that $1.50 must be an illiquidity discount because that you could have waited the 3 months and got the $11.50. Already you can see some of the potential problems with the study. Because it takes the IPO price as a given that you would have known 3 months ago and says that discount is an illiquidity discount. Those are the two sets of studies. So let me at least show you what the evidence suggests. For the first 15 or 20 years with restricted stock studies, they were very simplistic studies. They looked at the price. They looked at the price with the restricted stock was taken. They took the median discount. It's almost like that's the only number they remember from the statistics class is the median. They said median discount is 30%. 35%. Appraisers loved it. Why do they love it? Because the objective in private company appraisal is often to push the value down. They could go in front of a court and say, you know what, illiquidity discount is 30%. Here's the Maher study, the Maroney study, whatever the study is, the discount is 35%. Bill Silber often laughs about this, but one of his most cited papers is actually almost a throwaway paper he did over a summer. It's like a paper he did over a couple of weeks. Where effectively what he did was he took all restricted stocks and he looked at the discount. And he said, why am I just looking at the median? Why don't I look at why the discount? He noticed the discount is different for different restricted stock issues. He said, maybe I can explain why there are differences. So he ran a regression of the restricted stock price to the actual price. So think of that as 1 minus the discount against the revenues of the company making the restricted stock issue. To see if larger companies had bigger or smaller discounts than smaller companies. He also looked at how big the restricted block was relative to the total number of shares, arguing that if it's a bigger block, it should be a bigger discount. Whether the company was making money, arguing that money-losing companies probably have to attach a bigger discount than money-making companies. And finally, just to cover the potential that there was some side game going on, he looked to see whether the investor taking the restricted stock had a customer or a supplier relationship. And who cares? They might be getting other benefits on the side, so they might settle for a lower discount. Basically, he found that the larger the revenues of the company, the smaller the discount. Which makes sense. Larger company, smaller discount. The larger the block size, the bigger the discount. Which makes sense if you're trying to put a big block out there. Money-making companies had much smaller discounts than money-losing companies. And he found that this customer thing wasn't statistically significant. So think of this as restricted stock study plus, because it took the numbers and added that extra step. If you start with I don't like restricted stock studies, and I'll tell you why, even with the Silber study. But if you decided to use the restricted stock studies to come up with a liquidity discount for your company, there might be a way in which you can use the Silber study to differentiate across companies. Because what does it say? Big companies should have smaller discounts than small companies. Money-making companies should have smaller discounts than money-losing companies. So what I did was I took the regression. I took a base discount. I said, let's assume that you as an appraiser have a base discount. The base discount is, let's say, 25% for a company with revenues of $10 million. So that's what you'd apply. I come to you with a company with $100 million in revenues. And it's a money-making company. You're saying, who cares? 100 million is much bigger than the typical company that you attach a discount to, so the discount is going to be smaller. And because it's money-making, the discount you will attach to my company is only 21%. If I'm a billion-dollar company, the discount is going to drop to 16%. So larger companies will have smaller discounts than smaller companies. Money-making companies will have smaller discounts than money-losing companies. It's a very simplistic device, but already you can start differentiating across companies based on the revenues the company has and whether it's a money-making or a money-losing company. But it's all based on those restricted stock studies. Until, as I said, about a decade ago, this was the ammunition that appraisers used to push those big discounts, because the big discounts allowed them to lower value, so spouses got half of a much smaller number, The IRS collected 30% of a much lower number. Everybody was happy except for the IRS and the spouse that got cheated. Okay. Now comes the problem. About 15 years ago, courts started asking questions about these restricted stock studies, like, how big is your sample? It's a statistical question. Now, how do the courts actually do it? They brought it. The IRS finally paid the money to actually pay an expert witness who actually knew what questions to ask, like, how big was your sample? And with restricted stocks, it turns out the sample is tiny. Very few companies issue restricted stock, and the kinds of companies that issue restricted shares are basket case companies. You see what? If you have to knock off 25% of the market price to issue shares, you've got to be really desperate. So you get a small group of really desperate companies, and you're basing a general illiquidity discount on this. The court said, no, we're not going to accept that. I remember getting an email right after this happened because now I'd warned people that this was coming. You can't use these small samples. You can't have crazy companies and then extrapolate from there. When this happens, I get an email from a group of appraisers saying, can you do a study for us? First, I don't do studies for other people. But here's what the rest of the email said. Can you do a study that shows that the illiquidity discount should be 25%? Said, okay, basically, you've already pre-decided the discount. You want me to do you a study that will back up a number? But that's the level of insanity. They must have found somebody who said yes, because a whole set of new studies started popping up, the IPO studies. And these IPO studies, there are some studies we look at the results and say, no way, these guys are lying. And I'll say this about the IPO studies. There is no way that these studies capture an illiquidity discount, because they find discounts of 45% to 50%. Let me ask you a question. If you were a Square investor 2 months ago, you had uncertainty about whether the stock was going to go public at 11 or 12 or 13, whatever it was, your number, would you accept a 40% discount on it just because you have to wait 2 months? If you were guaranteed the IPO, you would not, right? So what might explain why? So the data, they must, I would assume that the data is there and this is based on real data. So how do you explain these big discounts? Not only that, is every IPO that's announced an IPO that happens? No, a lot of IPOs get announced and they never, there's a selection bias, right? In fact, if you wanted to do this on IPOs, you know what you'd have to do? You'd have to look at all companies that announced IPOs, not companies that did IPOs, and work backwards. These studies started with the companies that did IPOs and worked backwards. And because of that, what they were missing was that maybe 35% of IPOs get announced and never get anywhere. We're going to do an IPO, but markets don't look good, so we're going to pull back. So the bottom line is, these are both terrible statistical studies. Small samples, crazy companies, crazy numbers, but people use them in courts. I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars taxpayers have lost because of these practices, but they have lost. There are real consequences to these numbers. But you bring this up to appraisers, they say, what choice do we have? Where else do we get to observe the effect of illiquidity? And what's the answer to that? I gave it away when I told you the initial example with buyer's remorse. You buy a stock, you sell it, there's an illiquidity discount. We call it the bid-ask spread, right? That's my answer. You got 8,700 U.S. companies where I can observe the illiquidity discount. It takes the form of a bid-ask spread. Why the heck don't you go with that big sample? Because I'm no longer looking at a sample of 45 crazy companies. I'm looking at every company in the market. So about 10 years ago, and I'll tell you why it's been 10 years since I did this, I did a regression of the bid-ask spread for U.S. companies as a percent of the price. So if your spread is, let's say, 25 cents and your stock price is $5, 25 cents divided by $5 is a 5% spread. So I computed the percentage spread for each company. Then I ran a regression, just like the Silber regression, but across all companies, of that spread against the level of revenues, whether the company was making money, how much cash the company had. So what do you care? If a company is all cash, there should be no liquidity discount. What are you worried about, right? It's all cash. And finally, how much trading volume the stock had. So I ran a regression. The R squared was about 33%. Not great, not bad. It's at least as good as the restricted stock R squareds, but a much bigger sample. You see, how the heck are you going to use this for a private company? You could be a private business. In this case, the restaurant you had. I'm going to plug in your revenues, so $1.2 million. The fact that you're making money, one. The cash you have as a restaurant, 5%. And you're like a stock that never trades. I'm going to put in a zero trading volume. I get a predicted bid-ask spread for you as a restaurant of 12.88%. You say, what does that even mean? I call this a synthetic spread. Basically, I'm saying if you were a publicly traded company and you were traded the way other stocks are being traded, your spread should be 12.88%. That is my estimate of your illiquidity discount. The catch, though, is I haven't updated this regression in 10 years. It took me almost 4 weeks to run this regression. I'm an incredibly lazy person. When something takes 4 weeks, my resolution is never do that again. Okay? But I'm willing to give this out to anybody who wants to do this. If you're going to go work in private company appraisal, I think there's a huge payoff to doing this and kind of using it as a platform for computing illiquidity discounts. The data is there. The statistics packages are there. In fact, I might even be able to do it in far less than 4 weeks now because our data is getting better in terms of getting data on spreads and spreads as a percent of price. But what I'm saying is let's open the door in liquidity. It's not just private businesses that are liquid and public companies that are liquid. Everything is illiquid. The question is to what degree. So if you look at this, the magnitude of the discount, the bid-ask spread approach gives me a 12.88% discount. If I'd use the bludgeon approach, which is what appraisers do, attach 25% for every company, it'd be 25%. If I use the silver approach to adjust my 25%, I'd have got 28.75%. It makes a difference to you. So this is not an abstraction. You're the chef trying to sell your restaurant. This could be an extra $100,000 you leave on the table. These things have consequences, not just the tax law that's affected. It's you and I when we do transactions. Any questions on illiquidity and attaching a cost to it? So that's private to private, and we can talk. Yeah. I'm sorry? Why can't you increase the discount rate for illiquidity? You could, in which case you have to tell me how much higher. I'd have, you know how I added the total beta, right? So that just takes care of lack of diversification. I'd now have to add an extra amount for illiquidity. I'll give you a way we might be able to do it. In fact, there are people who have started thinking about it. If you could look at publicly traded stocks, and you could look at illiquid stocks versus liquid stocks, and you can base it on trading volume, you can base it on spreads, if illiquidity shows up as a higher return, you should see illiquid stocks earn higher expect returns over time. So just like you had a small cap premium or a price-to-book premium, illiquid stocks might have earned a premium of 5% over liquid stocks. Okay? The only problem is you have to make it discrete then, liquid, illiquid, when in fact it's a continuum. But if you're willing to do that, you might be able to look at historical data, come up with a premium, add that premium onto your discount rate, in which case you don't have to do the discount. The only problem is I tried that actually in the process of looking at liquidity. It's very difficult to come up with a number which does not have a huge standard error associated with it. But that's another choice you could go with. But don't do both. Don't adjust the discount rate by pushing it up for illiquidity and lower the value for the same illiquidity because that will be double counting. Yes?
All of these factors in the model are worth looking can we bring the market conditions and the...
That's actually a good point. This is actually across companies at a point in time. Because it's across companies at a point in time, the regression should already reflect the market conditions, right? So if I ran this regression in 2008, the intercept is going to be a much bigger number, the starting spread. If I ran it in 2014, the intercept... So in a sense, if you're running a cross-sectional regression, it takes care of itself. Okay? But if you want to look at how illiquidity varies across time, you could look at the spreads for the entire market, look at it across 20 years, and say, what is it about the market that causes these spreads to widen or shrink? But the nice thing about cross-sectional regressions is it's already embedded in there. But it's got to be current. I can't use a 10 years ago regression then. I have to use a regression as of right now. Let's talk about the second scenario. You have a private company that you want to sell to a public. So let's say that you are the investment banker, right? I was a chef. And you're offering me how much? Even with the low discount, you're offering me $454,000. And I'm not happy. So I'm going to look for a better buyer. Go back to the investment bank. So I decide to go look for a public buyer, a public restaurant chain that might buy mine. Okay? What's going to be different here? Let's take each dimension. Do I need to adjust my beta for total risk now? Who's buying my company? A public company. Who owns a public company? Investors in the public company. Are investors in the public company diversified or not diversified? They're diversified. The public company doesn't have to be diversified. Investors in the public company have to be. So the public company, I don't have to make the total beta adjustment. I can go back to a market beta. This is good. That'll lower your cost of capital. Do I have to attach an illiquidity discount? What happens after the public company buys this restaurant? It's going to become part of the public company. If I, as an investor in the public company, want to liquidate, what am I going to do? I'm just going to sell my shares. I no longer have to sell the restaurant. It's the shares that are liquid, so the illiquidity discount goes away. This is like magic. In fact, all I have to do is revalue the company with a cost of capital of a public company, much lower. So 8.76% is based on the actual beta, not the total beta. So it lowers my cost of capital. And I don't take off the illiquidity discount. The value that I get for the equity in the restaurant now is almost $1.5 million. If any of you build up a private business, there are lessons in this very simplistic example that you could take away. You have a private business and you're trying to sell it, right? And you're trying to sell it to a public buyer. You have two numbers, $4.5 million. So $4.5 million was the value that you got if you sold to another private buyer. $1.5 million is the value that you're getting to a public buyer. So let's say you're on one side of the table. You own the restaurant and I'm on the other, the public company. So let's do a negotiation. What am I going to claim your company's worth? As a public company looking at you, what am I going to claim? I'm going to claim $450,000. That's the best you can do outside. That's what I'll pay you. And what are you going to claim as a counter, or should? Because you're a public company, you've got to pay me $1.5 million. Who's going to win? It depends. And here's what it depends on. If I'm the only buyer in town, nobody else is buying restaurants, guess who has the bargaining power? I threaten to walk away, and what's the best you can get if I walk away? $450,000, so I might pay you $450,000 and $1. Maybe $5,000 if I'm feeling generous, $15,000. So the value is going to go to. But if you're able to get three publicly traded restaurants or even two interested in you, guess what's going to happen? The value is going to start going towards the $1.45 million. If you're a private business, your best potential buyer is going to be a public company, and your best possible scenario is two public companies get interested in you because in the process they're going to push up the numbers. Now, would your answer have been different if instead of being a public company, I were a venture capital investor? What's different about a venture capital investor as opposed to a public buyer? Public buyer, we said, was completely diversified. Why? Because their investors are diversified. As a venture capitalist, if I am, most venture capitalists tend to be sector-focused. I'm a tech VC or a restaurant VC. I tend to be invested in a lot of companies. We all tend to be restaurants. I'm going to be diversified, more diversified than the private buyer, but not as diversified as the market. You see what's going to happen? You're going to end up somewhere between the market beta and the total beta. Where you will fall will depend on how diversified I am. So if I'm KKR, I'm more towards the market beta than towards the total beta. If I'm a very sector-focused VC, I'm going to be closer to the total beta than the market beta. So it again becomes a question of who the potential buyer is. So that's private to public, very similar to just valuing any public company. Just be careful, the bargaining. So if you own a private business, here's what I'd like you to do. Value the private business in a private transaction, come up with that number, put it in your left pocket. Value the company for sale to a public company, put it in your right pocket. Remember which pocket you put which number into, because otherwise you're going to get into trouble. When you get into negotiate, pull the number out of your right pocket and use that number. But be aware of what's in the other pocket. So the guy offers $1 million. He says, it's less than 1.5. I'm walking away. Before you walk away, think of what's outside that door. If there's nobody else outside the door, take the million. But you need to be aware of both numbers. You cannot negotiate unless you know both numbers. And I'd give that advice to both sides of the table. Because I've seen people overpay and I've seen people sell for too little. Partly because they can't think out of the box. They're thinking in terms of what their frame of reference and the public company's frame of reference, if they're lazy, is a public company valuation. So they're using public company multiples, public company cost of capital. And if you're a private company, your frame of reference is with other private companies. You've got to get out of your safe zone and think about what the value would be to somebody else. Okay? Now let's talk about a private company for an initial public offering. I did not value Square. I don't know why it slipped by. Right? But for the last 5 or 6 years, this is something that I've tried to do. Every time you've had a high profile, maybe that's why I didn't value Square. It's not high profile enough for me, I guess. But I've tried to value it just, in fact, I try to value the minute the prospectus gets filed. You know why I might do it right after the prospectus gets filed and not after the banker's offering price is set? Because if you wait till the offering price is set, that number embeds itself in your head, and while you're sitting doing the valuation, it says, look at me, look at me. You know? And in a sense, your value will move to it. So there are some interesting issues that come up in the context of IPOs that you have to deal with. Much of the valuation is going to look like a traditional valuation, because by the time you file the prospectus, your information disclosure requirements are very much like a 10K. So if you look at a prospectus, you're now covered by US GAAP. Everything has to be reported based on those. So that's the nice thing. You no longer have to do the chef's salary being added back. It should already be in there. But here are the issues that you're going to run into. Let me give you an example. October of 2013, October 5th, the day of the Twitter filed its prospectus, I value Twitter. I won't bore you with the actual details because it's very much like all the things we did with young growth companies. I had to project out the online advertising market, give it a share of that market. So high revenue growth, improving margins over time, the value per share that I got was $17.36. So essentially, that's based on the fact that by the time they get to year 10, I think I gave them 6% of the online advertising market, which is revenues of $11.5 billion. Margins like Facebook, cost of capital that decreased over time. So essentially, I've followed the mechanics of valuing a public company. The value that I got for the equity, let me pause, stop. Value that I got for the operating assets, present value of the cash flows, discounted back at the cost of capital, was about $9.6 billion. So up till that $9.6 billion, everything I was doing was like I would do it for a young growth public company. There are two issues with IPOs, though, which are specific to IPOs. The first is, when you do an IPO, on the offering date and you issue shares, cash comes into the company, right? What happens with that cash? It depends on the... In fact, if you ever read a prospectus for an IPO, they are required to tell you what they plan to do with the cash. And we'll talk about the different uses for the cash, but it has to be specified. Take a look at what they tell you about the cash because it's going to affect your value for the company. The second is, by the time a company goes public, a company like Square, it's had multiple levels of VC investments over time, right? 5, 6, 7, maybe even 8. You're saying, so what? Each time you make a VC investment, you make these special deals with the VCs, options you give them, which are puts and calls. I mean, so by the time you go public, all these options are ripe, sitting there, and you've got to deal with them. You can't act like they've gone behind the curtain, so you've got to deal with the options just like you're in a public company, but they're very much more complex because they've been built up over time. And from the pricing perspective itself, remember, IPOs are priced. They're not valued. Why? Because investment bankers have to sell these shares. And if they don't sell these shares, in most IPOs, in fact, in almost every IPO I know of, except for one, the investment bank makes a guarantee. Guarantee that if they don't deliver the offering price, they will make up the difference. So keep that in mind. Think like an investment banker, because later on I'm going to put you from that perspective and say, given that you have to pay this fee if you don't deliver the offering price, is that going to affect how you set the offering price? The answer is obviously. But still in finance, what do we call it? We call it the IPO pricing puzzle. Why is it a puzzle? You tell people that if you're underpriced, we're going to punish you. If you're overpriced, nothing's going to happen. In fact, that's nice. You're going to get a lot of overpriced. If you overprice, we'll punish you. If you underprice, we'll give you a lot of pluses and you get a lot of press. Of course you're going to underprice. So We'll come back and deal with those issues because they will affect how an IPO gets priced. But the initial valuation, if you ask me to value an IPO, looks very much like a conventional company. Now, let's look at the issue of proceeds. There are three things that a company can do with its proceeds. The first is existing owners can cash out the company. That's what's happening in Ferrari. Ferrari, the IPO, the cash coming in is not going to be kept in the company. It's going to leave the company and go to Fiat, and I think Fiat is the primary seller, so Fiat's going to get that cash, so it's going to leave the company. That's nice when it happens, because if that is the case, you can completely ignore it. The cash coming in just leaves the company. The second is, the cash coming in is held by the company to cover future investment needs. That's what Square plans to do, is plans to raise the cash to be used to cover working capital needs, investment needs, in which case, the day after the IPO, what's going to happen? Your cash balance is going to increase by that amount. And your value as a company should also increase by that amount because you've already built in your reinvestment needs into your cash flows. So that'll be, if you don't add the cash in, you'll be double counting it. And the third is you can use the cash to pay down existing debt. If you're the kind of company that's built up a lot of expensive debt, you might, in which case, what's going to happen in your valuation? What's changing? The debt ratio you use after the valuation will be different than the debt ratio the company's had historically. So it can be taken out of the company, held in the company for operating investing needs, or used to pay down debt. Let's see what Twitter planned to do in its IPO. So to value Twitter, I had to go look at the prospectus, and here's what they said they were going to do. First, I had to figure out how much they were going to raise on the offering day. And that's, you're saying, why don't you know what that is? Because it's kind of a test of what the offering price is and how many shares. So you got to go with the rumored number. And on October 5th, the rumor was that Twitter was looking to raise about $1 billion from the offering. The prospectus said that that billion would be kept in the company to meet future reinvestment needs. So I've got to add the billion. So if you go back and look at my valuation, you'll see $1 billion coming in from IPO proceeds. With Ferrari's IPO, there was nothing added back because the IPO, the cash was leaving the company. Here I added the billion. In fact, if Twitter had said that they were going to take the, in Square, it's interesting. I think most of the cash is going to be held. There's a segment that I think is going to be taken out of the company. I don't know whether by Jack Dorsey or one of the VCs. So take a look at the prospectus because it has to specify where the proceeds are going. Any questions on what to do with the proceeds from an IPO? Now you've got to check out the claims from equity investors. If I get a chance, I will email you the Square prospectus. And somewhere very early in the prospectus, they tell you the number of shares outstanding. And I think there are 323 million shares outstanding. Class A and Class B, and you know why they're different, right? The Class B has 10 votes, and Jack Dorsey has all those shares, et cetera, et cetera. They're falling. But then you keep reading. And then at the second half, the next page, it says, this share count. So they say in bold letters, there will be 323.44 million shares outstanding after the IPO. And you keep reading. And it says, this share count excludes the following. And there's a whole page of all these other units outstanding. Like in the case of Square, there are 110 million options. 110 million. That's almost one-third as the number of shares outstanding. 110 million options outstanding with a strike price of $6.46. What did Twitter just go public at? $11.50, $12? These are deep in the money options. There are another 30 million restricted stock units. Why aren't you counting them? Okay. And analysts and journalists are being extremely lazy in dealing with these. You've seen the market cap numbers floating around for Square? It's about $4 billion. You know how they get the market cap? They take the 323.44 million shares and multiply by the $12 per share. So we're done. Hey, no, you're not. Because you got 100 million or 150 million other shares outstanding. The true market value of equity today for Twitter, is it higher than $4 billion or lower than $4 billion? It's higher because the $4 billion is just the market cap of the traded shares. If you think about all those. So when you value Twitter, you can't compare the value to the $4 billion because if you do that, you'd be missing all those other claims. So watch for those claims because in the case of Twitter, here's what they look like. The owners of the company owned the common shares. They had seven classes of convertible preferred. You say, why seven classes? You know what that tells you? They've had seven VC rounds at the minimum. Because each time you have a VC round, you create a convertible preferred, and each one's different from the previous one. They have 86 million restricted stock units. Is everybody clear on what the restriction on restricted stock units is? They're just regular shares that you're not allowed to trade until you get vested. So basically, they should be counted like regular shares, because all that you're restricted on is you can't trade those shares for 2 years or 4 years or 5 years. They had 44.16 million units of employee options. None of this, this was not some deep research that I did, so don't get too impressed. This was right there in the prospectus. I'm just cutting and pasting in there. Okay? 44.16 million units. Strike price was $1.82, which effectively means that they're close to free, right? The strike price is close to zero with 7 years left to expiration. They'd also done an acquisition where they'd agreed to pay already. So this isn't a contingent. This is actually due 14.791 million units of shares. In my valuation of Twitter, the number of shares I used was 574.44, and I counted all the restricted stock units in the shares because I don't see the point of not counting them. They're going to be there. I valued the options as options, just like I did for a traditional company. That value is 805 million. And you'll see that being reduced from my equity value just as I would. So the options are being valued as options and subtracted out. So in the case of Square, the value of the options right now that they have is about $700 million. I have to subtract that from my value of Square as a company before I compare to the $4 billion market cap. Otherwise, I'm going to find the company to be cheap, even though it might not. So think about the IPO proceeds. Check out these other units. And the only way you can get comfortable with this is pick up an actual IPO, like the Square IPO. Read the prospectus. You don't even have to value. That might be too much work. Just read it, because it'll give you some perspective on the kinds of things you have to watch out for on an IPO. Now let's talk about the investment banking guarantee. So you're my investment banker. I come to you with Twitter. I say, look, I want to go public. You're, of course, dancing a jig. This is great news for you. And, of course, you create a syndicate. The way this works is investment bankers generally don't try to do an IPO on their own because they like to, especially a big IPO, they like to spread the risk. So you get 10 other investment bankers. And what do you do first? What do you think they should do first? I've come to you with a company I want to take public. You want to set a price for the company. You think they would value the company first. Dispense with that delusion. So who cares about value? I have to sell these shares. I have to price them. So I completely understand why investment bankers don't value IPOs. That's not their job. They have to price it. So guess what they do? They get on the phone. They call your portfolio manager. They say, would you buy Twitter at, pick a number randomly out of there, 15. You say, of course. And you're too enthusiastic. I say, I'll call you back later. And I call you about 2 days later. Would you buy Twitter at 18? You're still too enthusiastic. I hang up the phone. Call you back later. 22. Looks like you're pausing for just the right amount of time before you say yes. Say, maybe this is the right price. That's the initial offering price, $22. What I'm saying is abandon this notion that somehow when you see that first offering price come out, that investment bankers have gone through the valuation and this is the result of a valuation. It's coming from that back and forth with portfolio managers saying yes or no. And they set the initial offering price at 22. They must have got too enthusiastic a reaction to the 22 because they wait to see how people react to it when it shows up in the paper. Must have been too enthusiastic because they raised the offering price to 26. But in doing all of this, remember, you have guaranteed the offering price. So if you're wrong on the offering price in the wrong direction, you're going to pay. Wrong direction being that if you've set it at 26 and people are not willing to subscribe at 26, you have to buy all the unsubscribed shares at 26. That's what happened to Morgan Stanley on the Facebook IPO, right? They set it at 38. And for whatever reason, people wouldn't buy. Which casts as wrong this notion that somehow IPOs are sure things. That if you get in an IPO, that you should jump and buy those shares. So your job is a pricing job, not a valuation job. And you're saying, how do I price it? We talked about pricing. If you want to price, what's the tool that you have to use? You have to use multiples and comparables. What comparables? Well, they picked, for instance, Facebook and LinkedIn as their primary comparables. And you can look at sales users, and it turns out that the number that best explains difference in value is the number of users. You say, look, I know how many users Twitter has, 215 million. I'm going to multiply that by the price per user, which is $102. You got your pricing for Twitter. There's nothing wrong with doing this. That's your job. You price things. What I have a problem with is then the investment banker reverse engineers the discounted cash flow model to look like that's what drove the number. And say, let's stop the delusion. You're pricing things, just price it. Because then we can debate whether it should be $103 per user or $75. It's a much healthier conversation to have about pricing than doing what we're doing now, which is hiding behind the notion that somehow bankers are valuing companies. So here's the IPO puzzle. For the last 40 years in finance, one of the things that's troubled finance academics is when you look at the offering date and the offering price, that if you buy shares or you're able to buy shares at the offering price, you make on average about 15% on an annualized basis. There's about a 15% underpricing of IPOs. And they call it an IPO puzzle. Why would you underprice things? If you know what the right price is, why don't you demand the right price? Why aren't issuers demanding the right price? Not just, you could see why the investment bank wants to underprice it. Why would issuers accept it? And that's the part of the process I want to examine. First, let's look at why investment bankers underprice. And the answer is, of course, easier. You've got to guarantee a price. It's easier to guarantee a lower price and deliver it than a higher price, right? So if you know that the price for Twitter that people are willing to pay is 25, you're not going to price it at 25. That's too risky. You're going to price it at 22, 21, 19, 15. Why not 3? Is there a downside to pricing it too low besides embarrassment? Price it at 3 and the price of stock goes up 8 times. Then people will start getting, these guys actually know what they're doing. So maybe there's a optimal amount of underpricing. If any of you worked in an IPO, in an investment bank's IPO team, it's actually written into the manual. Come up with a number for the company, knock off 15%. I'm not kidding. Take a look at IPO manuals in investment banks. That 15% is almost embedded in the process, and you can see why. Let me ask you a question, though. If I were the issuing company, this is bad news, right? Because I'm leaving 15% of the table. And in fact, if I offer all my shares up front, that's 15% of my entire value that is gone on the IPO. I'd be really pissed off if you did that. You know what percentage of Square's shares are actually coming out in its offering? I think 8% of the shares, maybe. And that's actually become par for the course now. It didn't used to be. 30 years ago, when Microsoft went public, 35% of the shares were offered on the opening day. That number is now in the single digits for most companies. 8%, 5%, 10%. Let's say you're the issuing company. You're the founder owner of the issuing company. See how the process has changed for you? If I underprice, it's true you're leaving money on the table on that 10%. Right? But many of the VCs and investors in these young companies are not allowed to actually sell their shares at the IPO date. They have to sell 3 months later, 6 months later, 9 months later. So what kind of news story do you want to see in the paper the next day right after your IPO? Square shares shoot up on offering. You're saying, how's that going to help me? Well, that momentum effect you're hoping will carry over, so when you have to unload your shares, people still remember that good news they read. It's a very tricky game, but you can see why both issuers and investment bankers actually have a joint interest in underpricing IPOs, because you're hoping that initial momentum will carry through. It doesn't always carry through. So I'm not surprised. I don't think it's a puzzle. I think the way we've set up IPOs, you are going to get underpricing, which raises an interesting question about you and I as investors. Is there a way we can make money off this? I mean, let's say this is a process. IPOs are underpriced on the offering day. Seems like a slam dunk, right? What should we be able to do? create a mutual fund that invests in every IPO. The returns of this fund should be about 15% more than the market, right? People have tried this and it hasn't worked. So here's my question. What is it about this process that prevents people from making money of the underpricing? Let's say you start a mutual fund and you ask for 1,000 shares on every IPO for the next year. So you, every time the subscription opens, you ask for 1,000 shares. Are you going to get 1,000 shares in every IPO that you ask for? On some of them you will, but those are the ones you absolutely don't want to get the shares in. Because the ones you're going to get the shares in are the oversubscribed offerings. Say, hey, do you want 1,000 shares? In fact, the bank will call you and say, do you want to make it 10,000? How about 100,000? If you have your senses around you, don't say yes to any of those questions. But you're going to get 1,000 shares in every overpriced IPO. And the more underpriced an IPO is, what's going to happen? You're going to have a rationing. So when you look at your final portfolio, you're going to be overweighted in the overpriced IPOs and underweighted in the underpriced IPOs, and that's why the process doesn't work. Unless, of course, you're a privileged client. I remember when the Twitter IPO came about, I walked into Roy Smith's office, and he said, I got my offering subscription. Did you get yours? And I said, look, Roy, I don't have your connections. Eh? Good luck to you, because you have your Goldman connections and they obviously send you these offerings. They don't send them to me. So if you are privileged, this might be the... But nothing is for free. For being privileged, then you got to use the Morgan Stanley private wealth guy who's going to rip you off in other places. Don't worry. You're going to get ripped off one way or the other for being a privileged client. So I'm not seeking out privileged client to be a privileged client, because there are costs to it. But that's why it's not easy money. Because I hear people every time there's a big IPO saying, look, I just have to get in on this offering. I'm going to make money. It's guaranteed. Nothing is guaranteed. In fact, this is a strategy where you might make money 9 years out of 10, but the 10th year when you lose money, it's going to blow up the previous 9 years. Okay. Any questions on IPOs? So watch the Square IPO. It'll be interesting to see how this pricing process works out. Because at least in the initial days, it's all pricing all the time. Which brings me to my final scenario. You have a private business. You're not quite ready to go public yet, but you see a pathway to going public. So you're a small tech company. I mean, remember, the exit strategy for small tech companies is not to stay private and small, but to become public companies. So you see yourself potentially. You started this business only yesterday, but already you're seeing forward. You're saying, 5 years from now, I plan to be a public company. And here's how you see things working. 1 year from now, for the first year, you think that your own money will keep this business going. So it's all your wealth, and you're completely undiversified. Your entire wealth is tied in this. 1 year from now, you plan to approach an angel VC, one of those early-stage venture capitalists. That person is not as undiversified as you. They have a few investments, but they're all in these young VC tech space. Little better. Their correlation with the market portfolio is a little higher than yours because they have more investments in their portfolio. So the way this is going to show up is the correlation we use to compute the total beta. When you're the only game in town is going to be the correlation of this company with the market, 0.25. But as you go to the angel VC, that correlation will rise to 0.5. Let's say that the last stage in the process is 5 years from now you plan to go public. And you go public, of course, you're in selling to diversified investors, your beta is going to go towards your market beta. So what's going to happen is the same company, the beta that you use for that first period where you're the only investor and completely undiversified is 4. When the VC comes in, that beta will drop to 2. Same company because he's more diversified. And then when you go public, that beta will drop to 1. Do you see how this is going to show up in your valuation? When I do my cash flows, I have my expected cash flows. I've just made them up here just to kind of illustrate the process. My beta is, market beta is 1 all the way through. Not that beta that's changing, but because I'm getting more diversified investors get in, for the first 2 years, it's my total beta that drives the cost of equity. In years 3, 4, and 5, it's the VC's total beta that drives the cost of equity. And in year 6 and beyond, it's a market beta that drives the cost of equity. And if you imagine a more complex firm, you can have angel VCs. So basically, you can have different... And by the time you get to the fourth VC, you might have a very different correlation with the market than the first VC. You can have stages of cost of equity, which effectively means your cost of equity starts at 24% and ends at 9%. So when I do my valuation of this company, I have a cost of equity that changes. I have to do what we do when we have changing discount rates. I have a computer compounded cost of equity. I get a present value. And the value that I get for this firm using the right discount rates, which vary across time, is $1.5 million. Just to show you how different the answers can be if you screw up. If you leave 24% as your cost of equity in perpetuity, saying it's a risky company and all my wealth is tied up in it, failing to factor in that it's not tied up forever, the value that you get is 1.22. You underestimated the value. If, on the other hand, you ignore the fact that for the next 5 years, the investors in this company are not diversified, and you use the 9% cost of equity, you're going to overvalue the company. So if you want to do it right, you have to factor in. It does require that you look down the road at when you plan to approach venture capital. Okay? So here are my implications for private companies. The process of valuing private companies is no different than the process of valuing public companies. But when you value a private business that is expected to transition to a publicly traded company, like the company that I just showed you, the value will be higher than the value of a private company that can never expect to make that transition. So you came to me with a private business and said, look, you know, how much value do you think I'll get? I'd first ask you, what business are you in? So I own a restaurant. Odds are you're going to stay private pretty much for the long term. You own a media company, tech company, an app company, then the exit for you is a much more lucrative exit, so it matters. Which also means that when public markets do badly, guess what's going to happen to private company valuations? And I've heard all this debate about how there's a bubble in the private company space. The only way you can sustain a bubble in the private company space is the bubble in the public company space, because that's your exit strategy. If the value of social media companies that are publicly traded drops by 50%, I guarantee you, you're going to see drops in valuations across Silicon Valley of 50% or more. We don't have two separate markets. The markets are tied together. When one market, in this case the public market, which is the observable market, does badly, you're going to see I call this a ladder of pricing, which if I knock the top ladder down, all the ladders below it have to get knocked down as well. So there is this trigger valuation that drives everything else. So you can't think of these as two separate markets. It also means that if I have a private company in a country where there's an active public market, it'll be worth more than that same private company in a market where there isn't an active public market. In fact, that's the biggest change in Asia, right? And 20 years ago, we ran a private business in Asia because the public markets were thin and available only for big established companies. You stayed a private business. Across Asia, that's what private equity and VC investors are doing, is they're opening that space up, which means that it's everybody who benefits. It's not just what you see in the public marketplace, it's what you see in the private marketplace as well. So keep that in mind. The second is the value of a private company that can expect to transition quicker to being a public company will be greater than the value of a private company that will have to take longer. That's why technology. Private companies tend to be valued higher. The life cycle is much, much more crap. So for a technology company, going from startup to established company can take only 3 years. Consumer product company, it might take 12 years. So that's going to show up as well. Very simple hypotheticals, but implications that are pretty strong. So here's the bottom line in private companies. If you ask me to value a private company, or if I ask you to value a private company, never value the company unless you find out why I want the valuation. Is it for show? Is it for transaction? If it's for transaction, who is it for? Because if I'm selling my private business to a long-term investor who's well-diversified, the value of the company is going to be much higher than if I'm selling to a short-term investor who's not diversified. If you're valuing a private company for a legal purpose, remember that all you have to do is follow the rules that the court set for valuation. This is not about doing a good valuation. It's about doing a legally defensible valuation. Very different process. And when you look at private businesses, always remember that the owner of a private business has the option, which is not taken, of taking the money as in the private business and investing in the public marketplace. That's what the total beta does. It says, look, you can invest in a private business. It's your money to invest. But this is what you need to make to break even. And if you choose to earn less, then make sure you get the emotional dividends to cover the difference. You know what I mean by emotional dividends, right? you run your business, you get other satisfactions running a business. That's perfectly okay. Remember, the objective in economics is to maximize utility, not maximize wealth. So if you run a private business and you get immense joy from running the private business, that's wonderful. But make sure that you recognize that the returns you're getting will be lower than what you could have made in a public marketplace. I'm done, so I lost my mic. Okay, we finished 8 minutes early. What the heck is going on? No. Actually, I want to remind you that the quiz is Monday. Okay. It'll cover everything through packet two. I'll put up the review session for the quiz today. And I'll see you on Monday. I'll send out the seating chart, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a review session the TAs are running again this afternoon. So if you have troubles with the material, go to the review session.
Hey, Professor, how are you doing? One quick question. We're using the EV to capital multiple for the project, and we're using ROC. Yeah. Okay.
You try to look at it. We always have that issue. Yeah. That's true. Because of the same denominator on both sides, it is a contributing factor to the high R squared.
Yeah, because we're getting an R squared of 92% with it.
That's okay. That's not just because of the same denominator. Because there have been people running price to book against return equity, don't get the same
yeah.
R squared, right? So it is contributing, but it's not the denominator.
Okay, and then the other part is just explaining why we think they're undervalued, right? The companies that we're getting are overvalued.
Definitely explain, right? It should be a direct consequence of the regression, right? So basically, it's a percentage. So that will come out of the regression, will be
yeah.
output from the regression. If you decide not to go with the 5 that comes from the regression, and you go with the number 6 rather than the number 5, that's when the expansion
comes. Oh, okay.
Right? You might say, these were the 5 that showed up as C, but we're going to take this one out because there's a legal case outstanding. And Volkswagen might look really cheap.
Yeah.
So look, it looks really cheap, but I think that the legal term or value looks really cheap, but we're not investing in it. So you have that last judgment call to make. And if you make that judgment call, tell me why you took the number 5 out and put the number 6 out.
Okay.
The number 3 out.
That's for the number 2 question, the activist investor one, right?
No, that's
oh.
no, that's for the undervalued
okay.
overvalued. Even
right.
that, you have the choice to make. So you can decide not to go with the 5 from your regression. You can go with 2 from your regression or none from your regression and come up with 5. So this is the 5 we've chosen.
Okay, based on.
The regression is your 2. It doesn't
yeah, it doesn't have to be.
So you don't have to go with it. The second one is only a single company.
Yep.
Right? That yep. can be any company you want based on what you think.
On the leverage,
where
margins.
Do you think the value comes from being an activist? So the course you think about, how do activist investors make money? They make it by buying cheap companies. They make it by buying badly-run companies.
Yeah.
They make it by buying money. So you have to think through the consequences. Once you define what an activist investor makes money on, then the criteria you go looking for will depend.
Okay.
So if you say activist investors buy underlevered companies and borrow more, all you're going to be looking for are companies which have low debt ratios relative to some measure of the optimal that you have to come up
okay.
with.
Okay. All right, perfect. Thank you.
Hi, Professor. I sent you an email yesterday that one of the companies had no revenue lines. And
was Embev? And
Embev, yeah. Is it okay to just take that one out?
Take that out.
Okay. And we also adjusted. We tried like adjusting for operating lease and the R&D. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I noticed you gave us data for it. It's okay to use. Would you adjust it?
It's okay to not use it. It's your choice, right?
Because I was
all
thinking
that one is five cheapest, five most expensive. How you get there is up to you.
Because I was thinking instead of adjusting it, why don't we just put operating lease as a regression there?
That's what works for you. That's what. Remember, this is an intrinsic valuation. There are no rules.
That's true.
If this were a discounted cash flow valuation, you said this is how you have to do it. All you have to do is control for difference in lease commitments across companies.
Right.
So you can add up your leases across time. You're saying it's not in present value terms. It doesn't matter. It's a regression.
Right.
The ranking you get captures that lease overhang. Okay.
And lastly, about the my DCF valuation,
right.
I know I sent like cryptic emails over the weekend, but I noticed that my company's been issuing equity throughout the past 3 years more than it's been giving out in dividends.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's been reinvesting more than it's earning.
But at least it's getting cash in. So
yeah.
We don't know whether it's reinvesting, whether it's building up its regulatory capital. It's a financial service company.
It's a financial service company.
It might be building its regulatory capital base. The question is it done building it up or is it going
yeah.
to continue? And that would require that you look at the regulatory capital ratio they have.
Mm-hmm.
Come up with a target if you think it's going to be higher. Because if they're not done, that's what it means, right? The target debt regulatory capital ratio is higher than where they are.
Yeah.
And then you do what we did in Deutsche Bank, is actually come up with how much more they will have to raise each year to get to the regulatory capital.
But if I don't know how they calculated the, because they calculated by the rated, the risk-weighted assets.
No, you know
what
the regulatory, it's a reporting requirement, right?
Yeah.
They'll tell you what their Tier 1 capital is.
But we don't know how they calculated, right?
You don't have to calculate it. It should be given.
Yeah, but right? I mean for future years, if they want
to. You have to give the target, right? So you know what the ratio is. So
yeah.
That judgment call you have to make, like in any other company. So you can say right now it's 8.7%.
Right.
It's gone up from 6.5 to 8.7. You have to decide whether 8.7 is steady state or whether it's going to go to 10. That's a judgment call you got to make given what the managers seem to be saying, given what the Fed is releasing as capital requirements. But that's the call you have to make, and that call will drive the value of the company.
Right, but my question is, say it's target Tier 1 ratio is 12%. Right now it's at 10%. But I don't know how they calculate their Tier 1 ratio.
Sure you do. It's Tier 1 to risk-adjusted assets. They're both given.
But Tier 1 is not exactly equal to equity, though, right?
No, it's not. But yeah. Tier 1 is actually specified in the back. It should be reported separately. And you have the risk-adjusted assets reported separately. Right? So you have both numbers right now. You know what the target is. So basically, you got to tell me, if you grow, your risk-adjusted assets will grow. So let's say you decide to put in a 5% growth in your company.
Uh-huh.
Your risk-adjusted assets will grow 5% a year.
Right.
Your ratio will go from 10 to 10.4 to 10.8 to 11.2 to 11.6 to 12. So each year what you'll do is take the ratio, multiply by risk-adjusted assets. That gives you the regulatory capital you need in that year. Take the change. That'll become your reinvestment.
Ah, okay, got it.
So it's a three-layered process, basically. Regulatory capital target, what do you think will happen to risk-adjusted assets?
And last thing, there's a lot of people waiting, but I also told you that my company really does three businesses, distressed asset management, financial services, and instant asset management. They split it down into like total revenue, net assets, and net income. But since I'm doing a dividend discount model, they don't break down dividend too.
So if it's a dividend discount model, you can't do it by segment. In fact, if you're doing a dividend discount model, why are you estimating reinvestment? Is it just check to see if they can pay the reinvestment? Because dividends are dividends. Are you trying to estimate potential?
I need to estimate the growth of the dividends, right? So I need to find out how much.
You're trying to do a free cash flow equity model. It's no longer a dividend discount model. If you're trying to do net income minus reinvestment, that's fine. You've shifted away from a dividend discount model to a potential free cash flow equity, because the numbers you get when you subtract out the reinvestment then could be a number very different than, so last year's dividends might have been $800 million.
Yeah.
But you could end up with a negative potential dividend with your assumptions, so that's fine. So you're no longer using a dividend discount model. You're doing regulatory capital reinvestment.
But I'm thinking, how else would you get the growth rate unless you find out how much they're reinvesting, right, even for a dividend discount model?
No, dividend discount model, the growth rate is just your retention ratio. You would never do reinvestment. It's just retention ratio times return on equity. Because dividends come from net income, and the dividends basically, net income comes from both cash and non-cash investments. So you don't even care. As long as the money goes back into the company, it's retention. So when you're doing a dividend discount model, you don't need a reinvestment rate. You just need a retention ratio. So they're paying out 40% of their earnings as dividends.
But do I need a growth rate still for a dividend discount model?
Yeah, the retention ratio is return equity. Your growth rate is a computer number, right? You have an equation with three variables. You can specify only two of them, right? You can't do retention ratio, return equity, and growth rate because you've over-identified the equation. You pick two of the three. And my suggestion is take the retention ratio and return equity. The growth rate then is the output.
Okay.
So if you have a 20% return equity and you're reinvesting 60%, or your retention ratio is 60%, the growth rate is 12%.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I should choose either of the two.
Either do potential dividends or do actual dividends. Don't mix the two because they're completely confusing.
Got it.
Hi, confusion about the consistency between the P multiples and also the factor that you use in the calculation. As you mentioned about the forward P you use, because it already reflects the future
some of the growth. So you can't use an expected growth rate on a forward P.
Because let's say,
you see what I'm saying? Let's say you have 12% growth for the next 5 years, but 80% of that growth is going to happen next year. When you use a forward PE, then next year's earnings will already reflect that growth, so your PE is going to be low.
Yeah.
Then if you put in the 12% growth, you've actually double-counted the growth, once by pushing down your PE, and once by... So if you use a expected growth in earnings per share, you have to use trailing earnings.
Okay. trading PEs and the match with the expected PEs.
Because that's
PEs
what they base.
The
because it's got to be of the same number that the growth rate is computed.
Okay, so use a base year's PE ratio. That is trading PE.
When you say base, are you talking about trailing?
Trailing PE.
The last 12 months.
Last 12 months,
and then you can include the G factor.
And if you want to take out the growth, then all odds are off. If you don't want to have a growth rate in your variable, then you can use forward PE. That's fine.
Some of my team members are trying to address the PE by like an operating lease or something. Then the factor that
PE
using the regression.
PE is not affected by operating leases.
Yeah, so.
It's not affected by nothing. It shouldn't. PE is an operating lease. You're just moving an item from above the operating to below. So your net income should be unaffected by lease. So if your net income is changing, something is wrong with the way you're treating leases.
Okay.
You're just replacing one type of expense with a different kind of expense.
Thank you,
Professor.
Yeah. For the mystery project this Friday, so we're looking at the list of the potential takeover targets.
Mm-hmm.
What type of analysis do you want to see? We went through the list, started screening with multiples.
You have to decide first what an activist investor does.
Okay. So we,
I can't tell you what it is unless you specify that. So that definition will drive what you look for.
Okay.
And so you tell me that activist investors buy under-levered companies and just fix the leverage, or you're going to be looking for companies with low debt ratio that you can get cheap.
Okay. And then do you want any sort of analysis like an LBO or something like that or that sort? Or?
I don't see what you have to do.
Okay.
You just have to identify the target. By telling me what target is, you also told me what you're going to do.
Talking about how you do it. Okay.
That's why you have to start with how does an activist investor
okay.
create value?
It.
Is it by buying cheap companies, by buying
okay.
badly managed companies, by buying under-levered companies?
And then we run
that
those.
Decision will then drive how you screen.
Do you have any suggestion on how long you want to go right up to be?
Very short.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll keep looking. I've had a chance because I can tell you why.
What were you doing down there?
I was giving the keynote for the CFA conference.
How'd it go?
Well, I've done it 18 years in a row. So a bunch of portfolio managers and old CFAs.
Did they try to come at you with some stuff or not?
I mean, most of the people in the audience have seen 15 times, 20 times, 25 times.
Do you think some of them are smart?
Oh, yeah, they're bright people. They're just different audience, very different. The portfolio managers. So it's very different from a New York audience,
yeah.
your banking audience, the portfolio management audience. So they come from all small portfolio firms, large.
They also come from different backgrounds, too.
Yeah,
like, they're not, like...
They're not the CFAs. They're not MBAs. They've come up the ranks. So
a lot of them are, like, come from, like, blue-collar type
it's
of...
It's a very different audience.